This webcast is a service of SDPB. More information at sd.net.
Good morning. We want to welcome all of you to our court session today. We have three cases set for oral argument. We go on the road twice a year, once in October we go to the University of South Dakota Law School, and then in the spring in March we go to one of the universities in other areas of the state. And this year Black Hills State invited us, and we're thrilled to be here. We appreciate the invitation from them and the time to sit in court over the last 3 days. I want to welcome, we have three high schools that are here today, the Hewlett Wyoming High School students, Custer High School, and Belle Fouche High School. So welcome to all of you. The first case set for oral argument this morning is appeal number 30764, State of South Dakota versus Timothy Huante. Aaron Hanke is appearing on behalf of the State of South Dakota. We'll be arguing the appellant, and Gregory Spurlick will be arguing on behalf of the defendant appellee, Mr. Huante, and Angela Kolbath is also present at council table. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Ms. Hanke, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. You can proceed with your argument, Ms. Hanke.
May it please the court, counsel. Timothy Huante confessed to killing Dallas Quickbear. His counsel filed a notice of intent to offer Dr. Manlove as an expert on false confessions and police interrogation tactics. The state objected to his qualifications. And after a 2-day hearing, the court ruled that Dr. Manlove could testify regarding four things: false confessions in general, how certain interrogation techniques can lead to false confessions, how certain people are more likely to make false confessions, and the hallmark of false confessions. The state appealed this ruling and is arguing not only is Dr. Manlove not qualified as an expert in false confessions or police interrogation techniques, but also that such testimony is not relevant and invades the province of the jury. Dr. Manlove is an experienced psychiatrist. The circuit court found that Dr. Manlove's experience as a forensic psychiatrist to be an umbrella specialty, with false confessions a subsect within that umbrella specialty. But Dr. Manlove's qualifications do not meet the requirements of 702 to make him an expert in false confessions. Rule 702 is a guideline for the courts to look at when determining whether or not an expert is qualified to testify at a trial. Things the circuit court looks at include the expert's scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge that will help the trier of fact to understand the evidence and determine the facts at issue, that the testimony is based on sufficient facts or data, and that the testimony is a product of reliable principles and methods, and finally, that the expert has reliably applied the principles and methods to the facts of the case. Dr. Manlove's CV contains no mention or reference of false confessions. Out of approximately the 200 cases he has been an expert witness, he estimated that 3 to 4 of those cases were on false confessions. However, he cannot remember any details, like if they were state or federal cases, or if he even testified, or if he was a consultant, whether or not he testified at trial or a hearing. I know Mr. Spurlich references a case that Dr. Manlove did testify at. I believe it was United States v. Pumpkin Seed, but...
But the test isn't whether he's ever testified in a false confession case. Would you agree with that?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So... if we're talking about his qualifications, he's obviously qualified as a psychiatrist and has testified in court, forensic psychologist or psychiatrist. So as we're thinking about that, I know the state's argument is, well, he was reading a lot of articles about false confessions and he was basically just cut and pasting those things. And I get that, But he's also using his expertise, is he not? Yeah, that clock is beeping. Shirley is keeping track of time,
okay.
So she'll let us know when we're close. But there's also the fact that he's an expert. He understands interview techniques. He understands how that may impact the psyche of individuals as they're in that situation. So why is this any different than the other expert? Digging into some of the articles and things like that, and the fact he hasn't testified, we have a pretty broad standard for an expert in terms of qualifications. So why isn't that adequate?
Certainly, Your Honor. So with false confessions, yes, the state agrees. I will back up. The state does agree. He has been an expert in psychiatry, specifically forensic psychiatry. We're not contesting that. What we are contesting is the specialized subsect knowledge of false confessions. And simply,
is your argument one that is more categorical than this case, or is it restricted to this case? In other words, the abuse of discretion that you allege exists, is that confined to this case, this expert, or does it apply more broadly to this type of evidence in the sense that maybe, you feel that the state of the art isn't just advanced enough, or how far ranging is your argument?
Sure. Certainly the primary objective of the state's argument today is Dr. Manlove specific to this case and the qualifications as an expert in false confessions. However, the state does call into question the science behind false confessions in general and does think that based on briefing and presumably the arguments presented today, that if this court would like to take it a step further and address false confession evidence in general, it's been raised enough, but like I said, the primary objective of the state is focusing on case specific to Dr. Manlove in this
case.
Could
you ever visualize a case in which a different expert offered testimony that satisfied the Rule 702 standard, was reliable, relevant, fit with the facts of the case? Could you envision something like that? Potentially.
Possibly, Your Honor. However, the scientific background for false confessions is still not, it's still on shaky grounds, I'll say. It doesn't seem like it's quite as widely accepted, much that we look for in expert testimony. So the foundation of false confession expertise or false confession evidence is questionable. Could there be an expert out there that would meet that qualification? Possibly. But that's not what we're presented with today. We are looking specifically at Dr. Manlove. And going back to your question, Chief Justice, about, he did his own research. Isn't that enough? And it simply is not. Reading a few articles is vastly different than implementing and working in this arena on a regular basis.
So Dr. Manlove went to medical school. He got a specialty in psychiatry. He conducted independent research about this topic. What else did he need to do to become an expert? What else would you have expected him to do to become a qualified expert?
In false confession specifically, Your Honor, it would be having more of his practice dedicated to false confessions. He said himself he's only worked on like maybe 3 or 4 cases in that arena.
How many more cases does he need to work on?
I don't think there's a bright line rule, Your Honor.
Okay, so the circuit judge assessed this circumstance and determined it was sufficient. Our standard is abuse of discretion, correct?
Correct.
So you think the judge abused his discretion based on the evidence that was before him in concluding that the amount of work that this doctor put in was insufficient to make him an expert?
Correct, Your Honor. And specifically, the circuit court abused its discretion by not appropriately applying Rule 702. In its analysis.
In what way did he fail to apply Rule 702?
For instance, one of the requirements for 702, the experts must have scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge that will help the trier of fact. There's a couple points there.
The circuit court made specific findings that Dr. Manlove had sufficient scientific and technical knowledge. He didn't ignore that requirement.
He didn't ignore it. He misapplied it, Your Honor.
In what way did he misapply it?
because Dr. Manlove doesn't have that scientific or technical or specialized knowledge. Again, attending a couple of courses, which again, we don't know the quality of those courses. Was it a simple one-hour seminar? Was it a two-day seminar? And reading a couple of journals and just regurgitating what those journals have does not mean he has that technical or specialized knowledge that he can go on to further apply.
So my earlier question was kind of driving at, the helpfulness, maybe, of this testimony, potentially. And I understand your answer. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go back and do that. But explain to me how this type of evidence, broadly speaking as a class of evidence, differs fundamentally from evidence in which an expert comes in and says, hey, here are the characteristics of a victim of a child sex abuse, sort of in a child sex abuse case, and this is how this victim compares with those, and we've affirmed those. Mm-hmm. So how does this class of evidence differ fundamentally from that, if it does?
Oh, first of all, in those instances you're referencing, Your Honor, it's based off of scientifically sound foundation. I don't think that there is any contestation in the science behind that sort of testimony. The other thing is Dr. Manlove's not allowed, per the court's order, to talk about case specifics in terms of Hawante. So if he were to testify about false confessions in general and why certain people are more likely to make a false confession, he's not linking that then to Hawante's statements to law enforcement. It's still leaving a hole, so to speak, in terms of why did Hawante say what he said? And at the end of the day, only Hawante can say reason behind what he said.
I thought about that. And that's that. You know, we described that. I mentioned it earlier, FIT. We described that in some of our cases, and not just our cases, but they talk about this FIT that has to exist in expert testimony in order for it to really be helpful. And on some level, I mean, I see the argument that maybe it goes too far or isn't based upon, you know, enough rigor in terms of the science or the reliability. But your argument just a few moments ago gets at this other aspect of it, which is maybe it doesn't go far enough in terms of getting to a FIT, right? Because it's not related specifically to him at all.
Correct.
And your argument is it can't be because that makes him a truth teller?
Correct, Your Honor. It does. That certainly goes into now we're giving credibility to Hawante through expert testimony.
Well, if that's the case, then it's more of a structural problem with this type of testimony. Because the only way, the only road that it ever leads to, ultimately, is, I guess, determining whether they're telling the truth or not. We're offering an opinion on that.
To your other point, Justice Alter, you just mentioned part of expert testimony is to help the jury understand. It's to explain something to the jury. And Dr. Manlove himself testified at this hearing, false confessions are a widely known principle. The general public understands them. Not only that, obviously we're kind of in a little bit of a different situation because we haven't had trial yet. So we don't know how things are going to shake out at trial. But presumably the evidence will show Hawante's statements. And
so what's the basis for the statement that false confessions are something that the public generally understands? That's what I understood you to just say.
Yes, Your Honor. Dr. Manlove's own testimony was false confessions are a generally understood principle. So if it's a generally understood principle, then what is the purpose of having an expert explain that to them?
I thought his testimony was the exact opposite. I thought the purpose of his testimony was to provide the alleged purpose of his testimony, what they offered him for, was to provide assistance to the jury in understanding that it is counterintuitive, that the general public does not understand that people actually confess to crimes that they didn't commit.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is his purpose. But when he testified at that hearing, he said the general public understands the phenomenon of false confessions and referenced the Central Park 5 case, and that when he tells people about false confessions, he is flooded with, oh, the Central Park 5. So by his own testimony is contradictory to itself. So is it a specialized concept, or does he agree that it need the general public understands it?
Counsel, turning back to the science behind false confessions, have you done an assay of where the courts are across the nation? It looks like the Tenth Circuit has a couple of cases where they haven't been admitted, but the Eighth Circuit has a couple of cases where they have been admitted. Is there a majority rule across the country where the direction courts are leaning?
It appears, Your Honor, that the courts are split on whether or not to allow false confession evidence in general. But again, going back to 702 and how the circuit court in this case applied 702, looking specifically at Dr. Manlove and his qualifications, it does not rise to the level that would meet that threshold of 702 where his testimony should have been allowed.
So I'm going to go more to the basis. As I understood it from what I read for his opinions, you know, he identified there are certain areas in the research that make a person more susceptible, and some of them related directly to behavioral science type issues. You know, do they have a mental disability? Is it a young person, and those sorts of things. It appeared to me, but I'm interested in your understanding of where he ultimately landed, that his basis here all relates to, because those factors he didn't identify, the method of interrogation by law enforcement. Is that your understanding also of kind of where what he is hanging his hat on for a potential susceptibility issue in this case?
Your Honor, my understanding of Dr. Manlove's background is, yes, he has interviewed several hundreds, maybe thousands of people.
Well, you're kind of jumping ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I'm just, it looked to me like that's the basis for his thoughts, which he's not allowed to testify to, as I understand it, from the court's ruling about why there might be susceptibility in this case, but that related to the interrogation techniques?
Yes, Your Honor, that is my understanding, that he is focusing on the interrogation technique and the techniques used to elicit what he perceives to be a false confession.
And in your view, is that a different specialty then, to start analyzing and giving opinions on whether that was used and how that impacts, you know, what he ultimately determines to be the factors that lead one to be more susceptible?
Your Honor,
Thank you.
And then wrap up. It is different, Your Honor. Interviewing individuals for their cognitive abilities and mental competency is vastly different than interviews law enforcement conduct to get information out of an individual. I see I'm out of time, so if there are no further questions, I would ask this court to reverse the circuit court's findings. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hanke. Mr. Perlich, you may proceed with argument.
May it please the court, counsel. I want to thank the court for considering this question, particularly in this format, which is an intermediate or interlocutory appeal. It suggests to me that this is an important question that the court wants to consider, and I think it is an important question that the court should consider. This court has said time and time again that experts should be allowed to testify. In the Weaver court, the expert was allowed to testify regarding battered women's syndrome, what we would now call battered spouse syndrome, and the cycle of violence. In the Johnson case, this court said that an expert should be allowed to testify regarding child abuse, the markers of a child who's been abused, and grooming techniques. In the Guthrie case, this court considered a psychological autopsy regarding the question of whether a death was an accident, a murder, or a suicide, and found that the expert, although they went too far, but it was harmless, was allowed to testify regarding those things. This court has a deep sediment of decisions allowing trial courts to do what the trial court did in this case, which is consider the qualifications of the expert, make a determination whether the testimony is helpful, will it assist the jury under the rule, and whether or not it's relevant. In this case, the trial court shortened the wheelbase of defense and said, I'm not going to let him get to this question of what it was that Huante said, what it was about Huante's confession that can't be right. The trial court said, that's too far. I'm going to allow you to do these four things, and that's all I'm going to allow you to do. False confessions have entered the public consciousness in some significant ways. Barry Scheck and the Innocence Project uncovered hundreds of cases wherein DNA evidence clearly exonerated the defendant. In many cases, those defendants had confessed. The Supreme Court has said time and time again that the most important evidence that the prosecution can ever introduce is a confession of the defendant. Once that's in, the trial's really just a formality at that point. Our rules of evidence, Rule 804, the statement against interest, buttresses the idea that it doesn't make any sense that a person would admit to a crime that they didn't commit. And therefore, that statement is reliable. The statement of the defendant that I killed this person is reliable and admissible under Rule 804. Yes.
I want to, in order for us to evaluate this, I want to make sure that I'm operating on the right understanding of what he gets to testify to. So I want to understand what your thought is, because so the court's order has these four categories.
Yes.
And I looked at his report, and it appears to be those are the subheadings of four different things in his report. So under each of those, there is a lot of detailed information that kind of goes in different directions. And is it your understanding that by the court saying here are these four things he can talk about, that everything that is listed in his report under those subheadings is fair game, with the exception of facts relating to this case?
If I understand your question correctly, I don't think he gets to testify to everything that's in his report under those subheadings. I think he needs to restrict himself to the court's order and those four particular areas, and beyond which he cannot go.
But that's what the area, so that's his report. It's a verbatim almost what those subheadings are.
The trial
court. So was that parsed out that, okay, but here's a lot of stuff, and I'll like take the first one. For example, it talks about the prevalence of certain the prevalence of false confessions, and then it lists a lot of different things. It's listing percentages, and here's how often this happens in this case and that, and how we know this is false and that sort of thing. Is it your understanding that all of that is fair game from the court's order? Because it's not clear to me, and I'm wondering what your perception is. What is the intent? What is going to be offered here?
I certainly don't think Dr. Manlove's report is admissible itself. Only his testimony would be admissible. To your question, what of the report would he be allowed to testify to? I think if it supports his testimony and it falls within the order of the trial court, it should be admissible. So as it regards the prevalence of false confessions and how they are counterintuitive, as Judge Pearsall pointed out in the Rubidoux case, I think that it's important for the jury under the rule, and it assists the jury in understanding that it is counterintuitive. The idea that a person would confess to something that they didn't commit is counterintuitive. Following up on that, certain interview tactics can lead a person to falsely confess. Huante's description of the killing is impossible given the physical evidence at the scene. So how is a jury to understand that, well, is he wrong? Remember, he confesses a lack of memory about the events of that night, or a partial lack of memory about the events of that night. So he describes he shot Mr. Quick Bear by approaching him from the side and placing the gun under his chin and pulling the trigger.
So, and I, just because I don't want you to run out of time here, but on that point, and this is kind of why I'm trying to figure out what does he get to testify. So the number four category that is referenced is the hallmarks of false confession, and then it says a suspect's description doesn't match other facts or is impossible in light of known facts. So that seems to be something that comes into play in a lot of criminal trials where those arguments are made all the time, and they don't seem to be really the type of arguments that it's necessary to have an expert witness, where you're basically just looking at, and it's something that jurors are asked to do all the time. Here's what he said when he confessed. Here's what the evidence show. There's an inconsistency in both. The state and the defense regularly use that kind of evidence to make their arguments to the jury. So how is that something that it's necessary or that it's helpful to have an expert just simply compare those things?
This court has said on occasion that when you're reviewing expert testimony under Rule 702, you're not to consider what the ultimate conclusion is, but rather the reliability and the methods that are used. To your question, Dr. Manlove will simply say that when he, as a clinician, as a practicing psychiatrist, is trying to consider what his client is telling him about what's going on in their life, one of the first things he looks at is whether or not that's impossible. Does this person, his patient, have a true recall of events that are happening in their lives? In this particular case, as applied to these facts, him talking about the hallmarks of a false confession, for instance, facts that cannot be, the defendant's version of the facts cannot be.
Isn't that just an evaluation of the evidence that jurors are asked to do all the time, and they don't have to have an expert say, you know, lead them through that process? That's just, here's Manlove, what he said, here's what the evidence shows.
Right. Manlove won't be allowed to talk about the facts of this case.
And so, I notice under that subcategory in his report, everything under there is about the facts of this case. And so the court has said, you can't talk about that. So how is there even anything left under the, what's the hallmark of a false confession? What does he get to testify?
Well, he could talk about the Central Park Five case, for instance. He could talk about a case where a person says, I killed this person and this is how I did it, and the police know that that's false. For instance, the police routinely...
Well, but how is that relevant for the jury here? So you're going to say, well, here's this other case, here's what someone said, here's what wasn't in evidence or that it was inconsistent in that case. How is that relevant to the jury here?
Because the purpose of the rule is that his testimony assists the jury in understanding. And I would argue that it allows for a broader understanding of the problem, which is that it's counterintuitive that people would falsely confess. Certain interview tactics lead to false confessions. The idea that there's contamination in the interview, which is they're adopting a set of facts that they didn't know about, but they learned about through the previous interview, and then they adopt that as part of their story. So now we're not clear whether or not they knew that ahead of time.
So
I'm endeavoring to answer your question.
Yeah, no, and I don't. So you mentioned Guthrie, and I think that is a good analogy. You mentioned the Guthrie case, and that's a good analogy here. And one thing that I noted in Guthrie is the court drew a line as to what testimony there was sufficient foundation or reliability of the foundation for the testimony to come in, and another type of testimony that was not, that wouldn't meet those standards. So the court said, yes, you have this person that is an expert in suicidal behaviors, and an expert in that field, that this is what he studies, and he can talk about characteristics, or not necessarily human behavior, what types of behaviors are consistent with something that would be a suicide. And they said, yes, that was fine, that should come in. But then the court looked at, but as to the question of whether or not the fact that there's a few factors that are present or some that aren't, then allows you to draw a conclusion whether this was actually a suicide is something that there was not sufficient empirical evidence or foundation to make that type of determination. And so that was the error. You can't do that, and the court addressed whether that was harmless or not. So then I'm trying to put that in the context of here. So you have a psychiatrist who's obviously an expert in human behavior that could come in and talk about certain behavioral characteristics make you susceptible to being coerced into saying something that's not true. But then when you get to the part is whether or not these were the factors, not whether in general there have been false confessions where people have been exonerated, but how do you evaluate whether these particular factors are the reasons why the confession was false? And that seems to be the same type of analysis in Guthrie. Okay, then when you get to that point, when you're looking at, here's the why. If there's this many factors or that many factors, and this is why it's likely a suicide or not. Seems to be the same kind of thing you're doing in this arena of false confessions. So there's no, yes, there's all this information out here that there are false confessions. But it's the what empirical data is there, and what is the foundation for that to show that that is a result of these particular factors. That's the part, and it seems like Guthrie drew a line there.
Well, as I understand Guthrie, what the what Justice Konenkamp wrote about was that the testimony of the expert, Berman in that case, it was permissible in that they were allowed to say that certain people will be more susceptible to suicide. And for instance, in the case of that case, how she chose to kill herself, he did not find that to be consistent with a woman of her characteristics. And that men and women, and this is rather morbid, but men and women kill themselves in different ways. And he was allowed to testify about those things. What the court found was error, albeit harmless, was that he was allowed to testify that in this case he did not believe this was a suicide. Dr. Manlove's not going to be able to say that Timothy Huante's confession is false. The trial court said that is a question for the jury. That's for them to decide.
But that, so that was my question under the subheading one, because if he gets to talk about the prevalence in cases and statistics, where is there, and I don't know that he can, because he didn't really seem to demonstrate that ability, at least in the Daubert hearing, but if you're looking at, okay, what is the basis for any conclusion that it was a result, that the false confession was a result of these particular factors?
Well,
that is the part that I'm, you know, that I don't know that we have that here.
Well, Manlove would testify that false confessions are, in fact, an observable fact. And we know that now because of the DNA exonerations. In many of those cases, those persons had confessed. They have to be false because the DNA evidence proves they didn't commit the murder. So we have the idea that this is a human behavior that can be quantified, that can be studied. And then the question is, all right, what is it about this? What is it about certain persons, not Huante, certain persons, that lead them to falsely confess? Well, a lack of memory is a classic one. There's always an overlap between an abusive and where their will was overborne in an interview and a false confession. We don't have that here. This is more of a compliant but false confession. Nobody was shining lights in Huante's eyes and blowing smoke in his face.
Well, actually, I have a question on that.
Yes.
If I could, please. Are the characteristics of this case that make this testimony, in your view, reliable, relevant, helpful, are they in some way distinguishable from other cases? Or, if we accept your argument, will this evidence potentially be relevant and reliable in every case in which there's a confession? And if it is, it is. I'm just curious about your thoughts.
Well, I think, thankfully, false confessions are rare to begin with. And so it's going to be a select few cases in the first place. I'm dodging your question.
But that's the question. Is it false or is it not false? And something that the jury can consider. So the fact that we have a confession that sometimes, or admissions or whatever, but sometimes they don't align exactly, they change. They don't align with reality at various points. They range here and there and then come to maybe a resting point. This case, in that respect, isn't all that different. Right. Will this sort of testimony be potentially relevant, reliable in this class of cases, if we accept your argument?
Well, I think it certainly could be. I mean, if defense identifies in the interviews things that are just patently false about the defendant's recitation of how the crime was committed, and this kind of gets back to the old corpus delicti rule, which is what other evidence supports the guilt of this particular person, I think it could be. It's important to remember here, Huante immediately recanted his confession within moments. I couldn't have done this.
Go ahead. In the instances where we have recognized the battered spouse syndrome, the characteristics of an abused child, how men and women, you know, take their own life, that sort of thing, those, of course, have been experts offered by the state. Now, evidence is evidence, and of course that's true. But the state, of course, has a burden. So every one of those issues that are connected with the elements of the offense are an issue. Relevance is really gettable in those cases. The defense, of course, has no burden and has no obligation to put anything into issue other than perhaps reasonable doubt. Does the defense have to, in order to gain that fit that I was talking about, does the defense have to sort of commit to this theory that, hey, we're not just saying this is reasonable doubt, we're saying this confession is false?
Would we have to take that tact with...
In order to make it relevant, in order to obtain fit under Daubert and Rule 702?
Yes, they have to. If they have to, because otherwise, what is the purpose of the testimony? If it has to assist the jury in explaining why that admissible under 804 statement against interest, and which is fatal to the defendant's case in most cases, can be explained. So, yes, I think that answers your question.
We've got one more question.
Okay.
Counsel, the court also is going to allow Dr. Manlove to testify that certain interrogation tactics are more likely to lead to false confessions, namely the Reed techniques, which conclude contamination and the police claiming or suggesting they have more evidence than they do. Can you describe the reliability of evidence that the court's heard that supports that? From the record, is there testimony in this record that the officers utilized the Reed, were trained in the Reed techniques during these interviews with Huante, and that those techniques were utilized? And then to follow up on what the evidence shows regarding Dr. Manlove's knowledge and qualifications to testify about the Reed School of Interrogation Technique.
I'll pause to note, and I know I'm out of time, and I'm going to answer your question, but I would pause to note that the Reed became famous for his interview of a man who's charged with shooting his wife. That turned out to be a false confession itself, but by the time that was uncovered, Reed's crossing the nation teaching law enforcement the seven steps of the Reed method. The problem with the Reed method can be that it assumes the guilt of the defendant, and it seeks to get a confession, an admissible confession. The difficulty in this particular case is that it was strongly suggested, if not outright suggested, that a video of the shooting actually existed, and that was suggested to Huante. And that, coupled with the failed polygraph, led him to surrender, basically, and describe an impossible method of shooting this man. To your point, there, it is entirely possible that now I've lost the plot. I apologize.
Provide us your recitation of the evidence that exists in the case to support the trial court's conclusion that Manlove is qualified to testify as an expert on an expert on police interrogation techniques.
Manlove's testified many times about coercive and involuntary interviews. That's part of it. He's also studied the Reed method, read articles and books about it, and determined that there are certain instances where a person with a professed lack of memory can be very suggestible. And part of the Reed technique, which Dr. Manlove would testify about and is understood, is that you confront the defendant with incontrovertible evidence of their guilt. The danger in the Reed method is that it's too good. It sweeps up the innocent with the guilty. And that's what our concern is here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. DePerdue. Okay. Ms. Hanke, you may proceed with rebuttal.
I will pick up where Mr. Sperlich left off in discussing or answering your question, Justice Kern, on the law enforcement interrogation techniques, in particular the Reed technique in his testimony regarding that. Dr. Manlove's knowledge about police interrogation techniques, again, comes from reading, I believe, the Reed technique manual, which he read in preparation for this case in specific. and watching hundreds of law enforcement interrogation interviews. He was unable to identify any other interview technique other than the Reed technique, and went so far as to say law enforcement didn't really use the Reed technique, or it wasn't solely the Reed technique that was utilized when interviewing Hawante in this case. Justice Devaney, I know you had quite the discussion with Mr. Sperlich on Dr. Manlove's testimony in terms of the factors that lead to an individual to make a false confession. And that is all Dr. Manlove can say, is these are common characteristics individuals have that turn out to be false. They're characteristics individuals have for individuals that make false confessions. However, he cannot say because Hawante has four of these qualifications, he made a false confession. Or because he has one in three, that led to a false confession. It's only these are similar characteristics in an individual.
But in that respect, it seems very similar to the testimony from experts about a child who's the victim of sex abuse.
Correct, Your Honor. And then going back to that, though, again, there is scientific foundation behind that.
No, I understand that.
But I understand your point as well.
I'm sorry,
that,
I didn't interrupt you.
Again, the only person that can say why Hawante said what he said to law enforcement in that moment is Hawante. And honestly, that's true with any individual. Nobody knows why anyone does anything other than that individual themselves. So to go back to your point, Justice Alter, Dr. Manlove's not filling that void of why did Hawante say what he did. And really that is, in terms of whether or not Hawante made a false confession or how much weight they're going to give his evidence or credibility or his statements, I should say, that is ultimately up to the jury to determine that. Juries are asked to make determinations on evidentiary issues all the time. They're asked to listen to the evidence, weigh the evidence, give credibility where they find credibility is due. And honestly, juries are asked to determine counterintuitive behaviors all the time. This court has seen heinous crimes come through, and some of those behaviors are very counterintuitive. It baffles people's mind why somebody would abuse a child. There's nobody who can say why that child was abused other than its abuser. And so the juries are asked to determine, did that defendant abuse the child? And so that is a counterintuitive behavior they are asked to analyze and make a decision on.
And when the state has asked us in the past to review a court's decision allowing the state to present evidence about the characteristic of a sex abuse victim to help explain whether their testimony was believable or not believable, we have said that the court did not abuse its discretion by allowing an expert to do that, to fill in that gap. It seems to me like you're arguing the exact same thing here, the exact opposite thing here. What the evidence here is evidence to try to help the jury assess whether or not this confession was true or not.
I think it still goes back to, Your Honor, Dr. Manlove's qualifications in this matter and how he is not qualified to provide that testimony to the jury.
But again, and this goes back maybe to Justice Salter's earlier comment about the concern that are we going to open this door up where every single time there's a confession, somebody's going to go out and get an expert and say, okay, here's my expert, it's a false confession, or it may be a false confession. But we're not deciding here, at least in my view, that this evidence is necessarily admissible. We're deciding whether or not the court abused its discretion. That's a much different function. A lot of these cases where you see courts affirming a decision to exclude that evidence, an appellate court, mm-hmm. and we've got there's a number of reported cases like that. But here we're looking at it's a flipped script. We've got to look at and make a decision. Did the court abuse its discretion in letting this in? That's a much different function. We're not the trial court. We're not the one deciding evidence reliability. We've got to look at it. It is in the range of what the court was able to do. And so that's a different function than we're just letting the court the evidence in. Would you agree?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that. I see I am out of time.
May I ask a question?
Oh,
go ahead.
Good, please. So I want to make sure I've got your argument, and I think I do. So is the concern with Dr. Manlove one that he's sort of learning this along the way, and it's not an area of emphasis or academic mm-hmm. study mm-hmm. or training for him mm-hmm. enough? And or is it two, that the underlying, no matter how hard he worked or no matter how hard he emphasized it, this science just isn't there enough to be reliable? Or is it both?
It's both, Your Honor, with the primary focus being on Dr. Manlove, for lack of a better word, being self-taught in this area.
So now the position is that under no circumstances could this evidence come in, no matter how qualified the expert, because there isn't sufficient scientific support behind this concept. That's now your alternative theory.
That's always been the state's theory, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, when Justice Salter asked you at the beginning of the argument, you said it wasn't.
It may be conceivably possible somebody is, but in
this
instance...
Well, how can you be an expert on something that does not have scientific basis?
At this day and time, there's no scientific basis for it. So that's not saying in the future there couldn't be.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. We'll be in recess for a few minutes.